Well, hi everyone, and welcome to the Modern Cotton Story, sponsored by E3 Sustainable Cotton. I'm Jennifer Crumpler, Fiber Development Manager, manager of our E3 Sustainable Cotton program from BASF, and I'm the host of today's program. So today we are going to shift our program and discussion a little bit away from where we have been at with the media and trade. And we're going to kind of move into a special episode where we talk about a new harvest and the market for cotton. So this season, I have actually this week was over in Memphis, and you know, prior to was out in Arizona, and you know, cotton harvest is in full swing all across the cotton growing states, and so it's really exciting time of the year. So I thought it would be great if we could really just bring some of that knowledge about the market, what's happening, some of the outlook for the new crop, and we'll share that with you, our listeners. So I'm also joined today by industry consultant Bob Anishak. So Bob, how does it, did you recover from being the special guest last week and getting all the, being famous from the episode?
Yeah, I tell you, I got a lot of fan mail, got a lot of
hate. I like it. Got some headshots, some signed headshots.
All the headshots, all that stuff. People wanted autographs and all this, and it was great. So thank you for asking.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to make sure, and I appreciate you coming back.
it's all fine.
All right. Awesome.
It was a good time. It was a good time.
It was. Well, Bob, again, appreciate it. But I'm also happy to introduce today's guest. I'm Gerald Napier, a well-known and respected cotton analyst who is the president of TrueCot LLC. He's worked in the cotton industry for many years, and he's regularly heard on the Ag Market Network, which is one of the events that we at BASF that we sponsor and that we do. And so, Gerald, thank you so much for being here today and really kind of sharing a lot of your expertise in the industry.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's a real pleasure to be here. This is my first podcast. I mean, we do the Ag Market Network, and that's a little different because that's a radio program. But my first, I guess, true quote unquote podcast. So it's a real pleasure for me. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good then. Because I think, Gerald, the last time you and I saw each other was a little over two years ago when you guys had we did your annual Ag Market Network call up from the New York Stock Exchange. So, so these are a little bit different, but glad you were able to join us. So, you know, Darryl, we mentioned that you really have had an accomplished career in the cotton industry as an analyst, researcher of the cotton market, and you're very active in cotton markets. You regularly contribute to many industry programs, like you mentioned, Ag Market Network. But before we go really into some of that expertise and into the market, I would love to see if you wouldn't mind telling our listeners, maybe give a little bit about your background and kind of how you got into this area.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Believe it or not, my very first job, I grew up on a, I say grew up, my father and mother, we had a little dry land cotton farm in West Texas. And I was 5 years old, and I asked my dad, I said, hey, Dad, I really want a bicycle. And he says, okay. So he hands me a sack. So it just happened to be about the time they started picking cotton. So for 2 weeks, I picked cotton and made $10 over that two-week time period. Then we went to look for a bicycle. The cheapest bicycle I could find was $20. And I said, oh, Dad, I can't afford this. And he says, oh, son, he says, I'll loan you the other, you know, $10. So, you know, not only did I have my first job, but also had my first debt, you know, at 5 years of age. I don't think he ever collected on that 10, but you never know. But really, I got my start in as an analyst, going to school, Texas Tech, getting a graduate degree in agricultural economics. You know, wrote a master's thesis on producer values for strength and length uniformity in the southwestern cotton market. I was lucky enough to join the Cotton Council as an economist under Dr. Dean Etheridge back in 1987. I got to Memphis about just in time for the 10-year anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. Didn't realize they had a whole week celebration, if you will. The locals are called Dead Week, but that was very fascinating, and I really can imagine.
That's really something. Wow.
A new appreciation and like of Elvis Presley music. I didn't realize he was so talented and so many, you know, we just think about the hip shaking and everything, but he had quite the background. So I worked there for about 3 years, and then I was hired by a fellow out of Nashville, Eddie Jernigan, to do research for him. He traded a bunch of futures and options, and I got an opportunity to not only do research, but was able to start doing, trading in the futures and options for cotton as well. I think it was in 1992 or three that the Cotton Exchange introduced a new contract. They called it the World Contract. And I went to Europe and really tried to sell these international merchants on the World Contract. And so that was a fascinating trip, getting to meet all the people and learning about how they did business, these European merchants, and how they hedged their risks over there. And then one of our customers was Calcott Cooperative in California. And Calcott offered me a position to come on out. And so I joined Calcott in 1994. And in 2000, as an analyst, became vice president, and then eventually president in 2009. 2018, I left Calcott and just have been on my own since then. Started out writing a commentary and sending it around, and then kind of stopped that and started working. A grower out of South Texas, I say South Texas, really the coastal Bend, asked me if I wanted to do some consulting work. So I started doing some consulting work for him, started doing some work for price consulting work for some other growers. Eventually I started handling a little cash cotton, handled a little Pima cotton here in California. And last year, for the first time, I handled some organic cotton out of organic Pima cotton out of Southern Arizona. And this year I'm handling quite a bit of organic Pima cotton out of West Texas. So I hope to grow that business over time. It's really fascinating work, and the growers are good to work with. I've also done a little consulting with a garment importer. I write a commentary for Morgan Stanley, and so I stay busy. Let's put it this way: got fingers and a lot of different pies out there.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't realize I knew you were the account. I didn't realize you were doing merchant trading. So that's really interesting. It seems like you do have your hands in a lot of stuff, and it's great because I know one thing we talk about on the podcast and really about with our E3 program is the transparency, within the industry and doing it. So it's great to see, you're kind of touching all of it, from the grower to garment importers, all in between. So that's great.
Definitely. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it definitely keeps me busy. That's for darn sure.
Well, you have a lot on your plate, and a lot of folks who have a very high regard for your knowledge of the markets. And that's why we thought having you on the program today would make perfect sense, with harvest going on and so forth, or just starting up in parts of the country. With the harvest as a backdrop, there's some big questions to ask, though. It's sort of like, these are ones I'm personally most interested in hearing about, is what's your attitude towards the future of cotton? What's the health of the industry? Do you see it getting stronger? It's been under a lot of heat, over the last, 10, 12 years, with a lot of competition from different fibers and so forth, and a lot of misconceptions about the fiber itself. What's your take on the cotton industry?
Well, I think if you're a U.S. cotton producer, you got to be optimistic. And if, of course, if you're a farmer of any kind, you've got to have optimism, right? Because you never know when a storm's going to come through.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, when competition's going to, you know, knock you back. But I think from a U.S. standpoint, I mean, all the work that that, for example, the E3 program, the trust protocol, all these things to you know, I don't want to say convince, but to let people know that the U.S. cotton producer is probably the most responsible, you know, environmental steward in the world when it comes to farming. I think from that perspective, if you're a retailer or a brand, I mean, you know, you should be demanding U.S. cotton. And I'm not saying other growths are worse, but I think that we are the most, the U.S. grower is the most advanced and the most transparent of any grower in the world. You know, a good example of that is, and I'm not trying to pick on India, but, you know, this organic program here in the United States has really taken off because of some questionable certificates of authenticity that were floating around in India last year. All of a sudden people got all worried about it and they had to turn their attention to the United States. It's not easy to become, you know, a certified organic grower here in the United States. And even as a handler, you know, I'm finding out how painful it is to fill out and do all the paperwork for the Global Organic Textile Standard. But and I'm not trying to make a sale for myself, but I think overall, you know, the U.S. producer is in really good shape moving forward. All we need is a big enough market to handle it. I mean, I think the U.S. is easily capable of producing and marketing and selling well in excess of 20 million bales as we move forward. You know, the challenge that the U.S. producer faces, of course, are producers in India, and, you know, Brazil is becoming a large competitor in the export market. They've got a lot of untapped ground down there, and that they can still probably expand their production. So, you know, if there's a competitor that the United States is looking at, a main competitor, it's mostly Brazil from an export position.
And Daryl, do you think with Brazil, I didn't interrupt you, do you think Brazil, because that's one area I know we've always watched very closely, as, you know, from the global standpoint, from trade and, you know, the biggest hurdle, I think, a lot of times with Brazil and cotton, whether it's on cotton or beans, you know, has been sometimes that infrastructure. And I think they're constantly improving and fixing that. Is that what you're seeing as well, as the infrastructure in Brazil to get cotton to the ports or getting it where it's needed to be as far as an exporter? Do you see that increasing at a pretty rapid pace?
You know, that's one advantage that the U.S. has over Brazil right now is, you know, we can store cotton inland, you know, we've got, and we can move it quickly. Brazil does not really have any storage facilities out there. And so, you know, they've got to harvest it. They've got to, you know, move it to the port. They've got to get it on a boat. You know, a lot of times that stuff gets on a boat and they don't even know what they've got until they've done some testing back home. But, you know, just getting it to the port is a major problem for them. And that's where I think that's where the United States really stands out. Of course, everybody's got some logistical problems right now with this pandemic thing. But I think when you look at the United States versus, you know, other areas, I don't think it's any easier in the United States than it is, or any harder in the United States than it is anywhere else. And it may even be easier because at least we're getting containers in. I mean, stuff is coming in here and there's something to put in a container to go back to, you know, on the Trans-Pacific route. So, you know, we've got several advantages here in the United States and people trust the United States. I mean, you know, USDA is a highly respected organization. The classing results are, you know, I think second to none out there. the PBI, you know, buyers can trace stuff back, you know, all the way back to the farmer, really. And so there's a lot of things that the grower has got a lot to be happy about and optimistic going forward. Now, you know, we saw what happened last year when we had the pandemic and prices fell, you know, rapidly down to, you know, to the 50-cent area. That wasn't any fun. But, you know, they have recovered nicely. Demand has picked up. You know, the government put a lot of money in a lot of people's pockets, and that's really helped the demand side. If anything, I think, you know, from a retailer point of view, you know, making sure you have enough on the shelves right now so that you can sell it. So I think that's their worry, if there's a worry at all.
Mm. Yeah. Thanks for that. Well, and I just have one question. It kind of leads, well, I guess it leads into my next question. And you answered some of it, but, you know, looking at, you know, with cotton, we talked about Brazil or global trade with India. How do you see that really evolving over the next few years? And then kind of in the future, you know, what are you seeing as some of the main factors affecting cotton prices, supply, demand, and some, and I know we touched on some of it, but, you know, just wanted to see what you think about overall global.
Well, China is such an important market for U.S. cotton, but, you know, one thing that's, you know, you have to worry about is the tension between the United States and China right now. And really, the Western economies in China, with the attention that has been paid to the, you know, the alleged labor abuses in Xinjiang province, and, you know, you import something, and if they even suspect it came from Xinjiang, you know, it's being held at the port. That's something that we've got to keep an eye on. Now, maybe what happens with China is, you know, all that cotton in Xinjiang province, it just gets spun and used domestically, and they're going to have to import either U.S. cotton or yarns from other countries, and hopefully those yarns from Pakistan or Indonesia or wherever are made with U.S. cotton, and they go into China, and then that's turned into garments, and it comes back to the United States. So, you know, if there's a, I guess if there's a worry out there, you know, it would be, you know, tensions with China. But I don't think either, and both China and the United States are smart enough to realize that they need each other in a big way. Mm-hmm. What was it in August? You know, we set a new record, I think, for imports from China, you know, it's likely to go up again. So, you know, they need us and we need them. And, I think that over time that will sort itself out, but, you know, you just never know what little flashpoint is going to, you know, kick something off. You know, obviously supply versus demand ultimately that's going to depend on prices. But one thing that's I think should help drive prices also, or if not, nobody's going to be planting cotton, are these input prices. I mean, these natural gas prices are going crazy. Fertilizer prices are up. You know, fuel prices are higher. Mm-hmm. Labor costs are higher here in the United States. You know, just this general inflationary environment here in the United States, and I don't think it's just limited to the United States. So I was talking today to a grower. And, you know, I said, you know, I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but I said, I think 90 cents has got to become the new 80, at least for next year. And they definitely agreed. So, you know, we're going to have to see some slightly higher prices to the grower to make up for these, higher input costs. And, you know, that doesn't really translate that much into much higher prices at the retail level. From what I understand, Bob, you might be able to answer this a little bit better, but I saw a little quote the other day, and from Cotton Incorporated, and I think they said that, you know, 50 cent per pound rise in, you know, in cotton prices, a t-shirt, you know, price goes up, or the input into a t-shirt goes up like by 13 cents. That doesn't seem much, but I guess maybe when it works its way all the way through the system, you know, maybe that's more substantial than I think. But, unfortunately, I think we've gotten too used here in the United States to just really cheap clothing. And that's been a factor of, you know, too much supply at certain times, too much, not enough demand. But I think that as we go through time, you know, consumers, they're going to want to buy better quality stuff. They're going to need better quality stuff. And to get that, they're going to have to pay a little bit higher price, you know, to the grower to get it and work its way through the system. So I'm bullish on prices. Not overly bullish. I think if we find a level of prices that everyone can live with, you know, textile mills, spinners, I don't think they care what they spin for cotton. Or I don't think they care what the price of cotton is, as long as they can sell their yarn. They really want a stable price. And I think growers want a stable price too. So I think for the next two to three years anyway,
yeah,
you know, we're going to be looking at prices probably 80 cents to $1.10, somewhere in that vicinity.
Gerald, I was going to just back on one or two of your comments on finished garment prices. One of the things I've noticed is import prices are actually down globally, and it's not because of the dollar or anything, but the inflation rate, as we've all read, is up at retail. So it's kind of a funny thing going on. Seems like it's these port bottlenecks seem to be contributing to higher costs to actually move product, and the delays. I think all that's getting passed on to the retailers, and in turn, they're passing it on to consumers. But Cotton Inc.'s point, I think, is that you make is very well made. At the same time, I should say, though, I guess in a way, I'm not surprised to see import prices falling, because there's such a glut of synthetic fibers on the market. And again, I'd be curious on your take on the role that synthetics are playing on prices and demand for cotton. Do you have any perception or any insight on that you could share with us?
Well, certainly. I mean, if you look at just, you know, China accounts for basically 2/3 of the polyester produced in the world. And, you know, polyester prices over there in China are 55, 56 cents was the last time I saw anything when you converted it to U.S. prices. And, you know, you've got landed cotton prices going into China at right now, it probably for decent quality cotton, you know, $1.15 to $1.20. Their futures prices over there are running around $1.49. So, you know, you do have to worry about, as we move forward, you know, will cotton start losing share to polyester? I mean, it's already lost share to polyester over the years, but I mean, will that accelerate? I don't know that it can accelerate much more. I mean, I think we still have a very strong consumer base around the world that prefers cotton over the synthetic fibers. And I know from a retailer point of view, you know, you got to put something out on the shelf with a price point that will move. Yes, you have to worry about it. I don't know where it stops, Bob. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess if the entire pie gets bigger of fiber consumption, And it should get bigger. I mean, what, global cotton consumption generally rises, you know, equal to the world population growth.
Typically.
And GDP growth. Mm-hmm. So if that entire pie gets bigger and we don't lose, you know, any more substantial market share, you know, our consumption is going to continue to grow. But, you know, luckily or unluckily, I guess the synthetic fibers will continue to keep a check, if you will, on how high cotton prices can really move.
Well, we saw that happen about 10, 12 years ago. Remember when cotton, yes, like soared above $2 a pound? There were brands, you know, they were just screaming to high heaven. How could they possibly, you know, keep product in the stores, even at such a high level? In reality, it still really didn't change their raw material ultimate cost of a finished garment, but it was a factor. But the perception was so bad that they all said, look, we've got to find alternatives fast. So they started going into a lot more blends, putting them on the shelves at traditional in-use prices. And many consumers didn't care. They just bought them. And that's the thing that's kind of, you know, worrisome, I think, from my perspective.
You know, one thing that I didn't mention was, you know, I think we're finally starting to do a lot better. And I say we as a cotton industry, and it doesn't matter who comes out with it, but I think collectively doing a better job about talking about how bad these synthetic fibers really are on the environment. I mean, you know, when you're finding, you know, these synthetic microfibers at the bottom of the ocean or, you know, fish and, you know, it's not good. And, you know, at least cotton will degrade over time. You know, these synthetics will not. We talk about sustainable, and I know the retailers and brands like to talk about sustainable, but how is it sustainable when you're, you know, putting product into the system that eventually, you know, ends up polluting the water and waterways and oceans, and, you know, that's never made sense to me. But I think we're finally getting a better education out there and educating folks about what it means if you start using synthetic fibers. You know, nobody thinks about, yeah, I can put my Nike golf shirt into the washer. You don't realize those little microfibers come off, they get in the waterways and they, you know, they get flushed out. And you know, that happens millions of times a day worldwide. So, and the second thing, and I'm not an expert on this, but this younger generation that they don't seem to, they're very minimalist, or at least appear to be minimalist. I don't know that they're buying as much stuff as you and I did when we were their age, Bob or Jennifer. And I know Bob and I are older than you, but.
Well, hey, I'm going to put myself in the younger generation, Gerald. I don't know what you're talking about. But, you know, I think you make a great point. And I think it's even through the pandemic with COVID, I think we've seen consumers, I know we have seen consumer buying habits change, whether it's, you know, not buying as much, going deeper into, hey, I can buy, you know, one thing. Yet is that minimalist kind of thought process, you know, what they've bought, whether it's being, you know, shirts and tops, and because we're on Zoom and virtual calls more than in person, you know, that's changed. And how we've shopped or how we've bought, you're exactly right. Like, all that's changed. And so I think that as, you know, the new consumer, as I would say, and we've heard from guests on the past from the podcast, especially from the university level, you know, that new consumer is very tuned in wanting to leave it better. When they make a purchase, they want to make a purchase with a company for a cause, not just to have it to buy, to have stuff. Wouldn't you agree with that, Bob?
I would, definitely, Jennifer. I think today's younger consumers want to understand how their products are made and where it's coming from.
Yeah. I think
that's really very important. And to Gerald's point, there probably are buying less product per se.
Yeah.
Or I should say per capita. They may pay more for a garment, but the expectations are there's a really good story behind it. They understand how it's made, where it's made. And the fact is that the product is not designed to self-destruct after wearing it twice. Okay.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, as we go into like the new, and you brought up a perfect point, and I've seen myself even change some buying habits or changing the way or the reason I buy. So we know, all of us know, it's already October. We're going into the holiday season, you know, gift season, whatever it is. And even as I think about purchasing for the holidays for items, I've really seen myself change in the sense of, you know, even my purchases for someone else being that, what is the story behind it? What is the, from what I'm purchasing, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
Well, Gerald, you know, we'll, I have a kind of question, I guess, switching gears a little bit. And you mentioned some of this about, and we talked about synthetics. And, you know, for as our listeners know, Bob and I, we both have very strong opinions about cotton in the industry and agriculture. And, you know, I've worked in the industry over 20 years. And I would really like to know, because you mentioned, you know, you're working some with organic or you're working with Pima, and knowing that you're in California, so a little bit different perspective, but would love to know, you know, what do you see as the outlook for some of that, you know, whether it's organic cotton, whether it's sustainable, whether it's Pima, what are you seeing the outlook for that kind of specialized or ability to market and truly trace a grower's cotton as some of that in that specialty market?
I think it's very positive. There seems to be, you know, a growing organic for the longest time. Organic seemed kind of a hit or miss thing with growers, but it seemed like over the last year and a half, it's really started to pick up some momentum. And you know, some I talked to these growers about, for example, on organic, you know, on organic Pima. Pima this year, Pima prices are fairly high because people cut back here in California because of the water situation. So Pima prices are at their highest level in 10 to 12 years. Organic prices, you know, track with the conventional Pima stuff, and they've been going up also. And, you know, one thing that I've been talking to the growers about is, listen, do you want a great price this year? Or do you want a good price for several years? And they say, we'd like a good price for several years. And I said, okay. I said, let's not go crazy with this organic Pima. We want these brands to and retailers to you know, to develop a market for this stuff. And so let's not try to go crazy with pricing, you know, our cotton as high as we can possibly get. You know, that's, and they buy into that. And they say, listen, if I can get a multi-year contract, you know, I don't have to have the highest price in the world. But it's difficult to get mills and retailers, it seems to be anyway, to get them to commit to a multi-year contract on the organic, you know, because I guess, you know, from a mill perspective, they've got to have the downstream order. And I guess from the retailer perspective or the brand perspective, they don't know how these programs will work out until they roll them out and see how they do. So, you know, it's difficult, but I do think that trying to keep a good price, but a reasonable price, you know, in front of these guys, it should help grow over time. Now, you're talking in California, that number's a little different because everything just costs more out here. You know, there's more regulation out here. You know, fuel costs are higher out here. Labor costs are higher out here. So, you know, a good price in West Texas for organic Pima may be an okay to middling price, you know, out here in California. So they do need more out here. So I do think that the future is pretty bright for, you know, whether it's organic upland, organic Pima, transitional. There's a, you know, something called regenerative, where the grower really focuses in on soil health, and it's not organic, but it's, you know, the grower takes whatever steps he has to take to minimize, you know, either chemical herbicides or insecticides out there. And, you know, the grower doesn't want to spend any money on that stuff. But, you know, if it's a choice between spending money on a herbicide or an insecticide or watching your crop get eaten up and it's gone, you know, they're going to spend money on that. So, I do think that there's something regenerative aspect of this. Again, that focuses on soil health, rotational crops, you know, try to make as few, try to, you know, just try to improve the general productivity of the land while minimizing, you know, any inputs on the crops. So I do think that there's a great future in all that. And I think that the U.S. producer is uniquely situated to maximize, you know, all those programs.
Gerald, virtually every program these days, Jennifer and I always kid, because I will ask the pandemic question usually. But it's on everybody's mind. We've touched on and talked about the impact of the pandemic a bit downstream, but I was curious, what have you seen in the farm community in terms of reaction to the pandemic? Has it been something that has really altered? Obviously, you know, the crops being harvested, it was late this year, but it's late because of weather. I mean, it's not late because of pandemic per se, but what impacts have you seen actually with farmers?
I think the biggest impact is getting labor.
Gotcha.
Labor has been difficult to come by. And you know, I don't care if it's a farmer or, you know, domestic spinning mills here, you know, getting labor is difficult. And you know, of course, some of that, without getting political in here, you know, some of that is due to these enhanced benefits that were being paid for people who, you know, because they were laid off from work, right? And now, you know, well, should I go back to work or not? Because I'm doing okay not working. But and people seem to be much more mobile now in terms of work, you know, there's, mm-hmm. I think loyalty to one employer is not as great as it used to be, right? I mean, people just like to move and do different things. And so, you know, getting a guy out here, a tractor driver, to want to spend his day, you know, bouncing across the field, I don't think it's not as easy to come by anymore.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. And, you know, I don't know, though. Some of these cotton pickers and some of the stuff I've seen out there, man, a piece of $1 million equipment, $1 million harvester, they're pretty nice. I don't know if they're bouncing too much now, Gerald.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, man, they're, some of that's pretty advanced. So, but Gerald, I do appreciate so much you taking time to join us today, and Bob, as always. And, you know, Gerald, if any of our listeners want to reach you, have further questions or anything, or connect with you about TrueCot, what is the best way for them to do that?
You know, I think just send me an email, Gerald@TrueCot.com, or give me a phone call, 661-978-6958. Phone call or an email.
Wonderful. Well, Daryl, again, I appreciate it, Bob. Thank you as well. And I'd also like to thank you, our listeners, for joining us and hope that you enjoyed our show. Should you have any questions about the E3 Sustainable Cotton Program from BASF, please email me at e3cotton@basf.com. And also don't forget to visit us on Instagram and Facebook at E3 Sustainable Cotton. Thanks so much and see you next time.